Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Thursday, May 7th, welcome, friends, on Into the Program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Today should be a fun one, Cherry.
Yes.
Sometimes you just see people, on the internet mostly, arguing about the same thing, and you're like, I'd like to have that argument. It's a fun-sounding argument. Let's have it on the radio.
Let's debate.
Mm-hmm. So today we're talking about this list that the New York Times came out with recently that generated a lot of buzz. It's a list of the 30 greatest living American songwriters.
Living
American songwriters. And we're going to talk to a couple of the folks behind the project today. We're going to ask how they came up with this list. We're going to listen to some great music. Mm-hmm. And of course, we'd love to hear from you.
Oh, yeah.
Who do you think is the best living American songwriter? And again, living American have already gotten nominations for people who are either dead or not American. So please keep that in mind. Give us a call. Make your pitch. 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org if you're on YouTube or Facebook. Comment in the live chat. We'd love to hear from you this hour.
Yeah, stump for your person, stump for your song. You know, you can give us an example. We'd love that. Also, it's Thursday, which means it's DJ of the day.
Whoop!
And, you know, this is a way for you to send in your picks by 12:30. So you can send us an example of what you think is a great song. Give us the reason why you think it's so great, with the songwriter included. And EP Kevin will probably choose someone we don't talk about today because we're going to be playing a lot of music. But get it in by 12:30 and you could be our DJ of the day. This is a great day, to have DJ of the
day. So to be clear, it doesn't have to be a song about songwriting.
No.
There is a song called I Write the Songs, by the way. But you don't have to pick something like that.
No.
Just, you know, pick your favorite artist, your favorite songwriter, living American songwriter.
Yeah, so email studio2@whyy.org if you want to be the DJ of the day. You have to do that by 12:30.
Absolutely. Let's start with a trail of local news stories, Cherry.
Yes. Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro has said that Senator John Fetterman should honor the will of voters by staying a Democrat and deflecting efforts to switch parties. The governor's comments on CNN come in response to a Politico story this week revealing that President Donald Trump and Republicans have been quietly trying to recruit Fetterman to the GOP or get him to run as an independent. Shapiro told Jake Tapper that he didn't know what Fetterman was going to do, but take a listen.
Pennsylvanians voted for a Democrat to represent them in the United States Senate. And so I think he needs to honor that and continue with his service to Pennsylvania and hopefully get back to what he was elected to do and reflect the will of the people.
Yeah, I mean, you all know this. Fetterman has been in the crosshairs of Democrats because he has sided with Senate Republicans on key votes that have really helped President Trump's agenda move forward. By the way, I got to shout out the Philadelphia Inquirer for their roundup of this. And if you wondered what Fetterman is planning to do, he told Politico that, quote, I'm a Democrat and I plan on staying one. And he went on to say that he would not make a good Republican. Clearly, no intent at this point to join the GOP, but I understand people are talking about primarying him.
His poll numbers are very ugly among Democrats, especially.
Oh, yeah.
So you would imagine there'll be a primary challenge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I have terminal reporter brain, I always think about why these stories are out there. Like, why is there a political story out there about Fetterman, maybe party switching, right? And it could be because he's seriously considering it. But the other possibility is that the people that want him to switch are trying to, like, put public pressure on him. They're leaking this type of information. And you never know which one is the reality until it either happens or doesn't happen. So I wouldn't run too far with this and say, yes, he's definitely thinking about switching parties because he's very unpopular among Democrats and it's his political survival on the line, because it very well might be that the people that want him to switch are the ones that are getting this story out there.
And absolutely. And I mean, if you talk about the balance of power in the Senate, they kind of need him, you know,
the Republicans may need him.
And if you look in the comments, every time there's a story about the Senator Fetterman, you look in the comments, Democrats are mad. Your voters are big mad.
Absolutely. Story number two, a surprising turn in a case that pits the Trump administration against the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. The federal government had been seeking private medical records of children who received gender-affirming care at CHOP. Late yesterday, according to the Inquirer, the government stop seeking those records. After losing in a lower court, the DOJ dropped its appeal to the U.S. Third Circuit. Now, this would seem like a win for CHOP, a big win, but the hospital is not so sure. They filed a motion that suggests they think the government is trying to actually move the venue of this case to a specific judge, perhaps in North Texas, who has already ruled in favor of the administration in a similar case. So it's possible that the DOJ is giving up the fight here. It's also possible that they're actually renewing the fight just in a different venue.
Yeah, and it's pretty unclear because the Trump administration has lost in seven other cases.
Right. And similar to this one.
It's similar to this one because they filed subpoenas against clinics, hospitals, and that provide gender affirming care, 19 different subpoenas all over the country. So we'll see what'll happen. But clearly the hospital is nervous. I've never seen a motion like that. A motion to confirm the jurisdiction of this court.
Right.
Very strange motion. So.
And we've talked before about venue shopping on this show. I don't know if it's applicable in this case, and I don't know if they've already tried it with a hospital in Rhode Island by sort of moving the venue to this one judge in North Texas. But it's unclear whether that's going to work. Like, the judge ruled in favor of the administration, but of course then there's a challenge over, does this judge have any jurisdiction in this case? And this goes way beyond my legal knowledge.
I wonder how they could get, you know, a judge in Texas or in another jurisdiction to exercise their power over a hospital here in Philadelphia. I don't know.
Yeah, it strikes me as odd on the surface.
Yeah.
But clearly, they have tried it already in another case. So at the very least, the DOJ is open to that possibility.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, these subpoenas are asking for the name, social security number, psychological records of kids. So a lot of sensitive information.
Right, which is why CHOP has been fighting back and has been fighting back for about a year at this point. So this is an ongoing legal battle.
Yeah. So we'll be watching it. Third story, GLP-1s like Ozempic and Wegovy are having a major impact on area businesses. If you didn't know, some Philadelphia restaurants are actually changing their menus to accommodate this growing population of folks using GLP-1s. Shout out to Alan Yu for that story. Apparently, Cuba Libre in Old City, love Cuba Libre, by the way, has created a special GLP-1 wonderful menu with modified versions of their dishes to accommodate these dieters. The new menu includes modified version of Cuban dishes that have smaller portions, more protein, they add some vegetables, and they give you half the portion of beans and rice. Mm. And so people like that. But it's not just restaurants, Avi. I mean, Hershey, you know, and Hershey PA also announced that while GLP-1s have slowed overall snack sales, they saw revenues jump 10% thanks to dieters buying protein bars and, get this, mints and gum.
Explain that one.
Yeah, apparently people are gobbling up mints and gum to combat GLP-1 or what they call Ozempic breath. Yeah.
Huh, I've never heard of this.
I did not know about this, but people who are using GLP-1, sometimes they have burps that smell like fish, or they just have straight up halitosis. And they apparently eat a lot of gum and chomp on a lot of mints.
Or maybe they're chewing gum to, like, you know,
stop the eating. I don't know.
Right, to compensate. Well, if you're not eating one thing, like, it's like a lot of people, they stop drinking soda, they start drinking like seltzers. Yeah, exactly. So I never heard of Ozempic breath, or I don't know if that's a documented side effect or something people just talk about.
Yeah, there's articles about it. They've been talking about it for a couple of years. I've never heard of it, but apparently Hershey is very grateful.
I am very curious about this whole portion size thing.
Yeah.
Because on the one hand, I'm someone who goes to a restaurant and I love getting a big portion, and then I feel immediate regret afterward because I eat too much.
Oh, no, you eat the whole thing?
No, I don't eat the whole thing, but if it's in front of me, I just end up eating too much.
Okay.
So it might help me to sort of, like, I don't know, stop me from myself by reducing my portion size. But then the other side of my brain would go, I feel like I'm getting a bad deal now.
Because I don't think did the prices change?
I have no idea.
The prices seem, you know, I feel like it's a way to accommodate people. And I do think that portion sizes had gotten really huge in America.
For sure.
And so maybe we need to dial it back.
But do you feel, if you get a small portion, that you're getting ripped off? I do sometimes, but I don't want to feel that way. I would like to be content with the smaller portion.
Yeah, I think I would feel like I'm getting ripped off just because I like to take half of it home. and get two meals out of one.
This is my problem. I want to take half of it home too, but then I sit there, and by the time I get to the end of the meal, I'm like, I ate three quarters or four fifths of this. I just can't help it.
You can't help
this
it.
This is impulse control. This is
so
my problem.
You're not a big
this
fan
is,
of this.
This is
GLP-1.
Not the restaurant's problem. This is Avi's problem.
But in years a lot of people, come, but, you'll be happy at these smaller portions.
Absolutely. I hope they do it. Speaking of problems, some people have a problem with this New York Times.
Oh yeah.
Best 30 Living American Songwriters list. Including Tom from Malvern, who says Billy Joel is not in the list. How could he not be?
A lot of people brought up Billy Joel, though. That has been one. We'll talk about why.
This is Dolly Parton, by the way. She's on the list, mm-hmm. as she should be.
Absolutely.
Tell us what you think about the 30 greatest living American songwriters by giving us a call, 888-477-9499.
I want to sing along. Jolene, 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 Jolene.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Cherry Jammin' Gray.
Bobby Wolfman-Erin. And the song performed there by Chic was written by Nile Rodgers, who was on a list that everyone is freaking out about.
Yes, the New York Times recently released a list of 30 of the greatest songwriters, but here's the criteria. They must be American and they must be living. The list spans genres from rap and hip hop to folk music and major names in pop. Some artists are household names, but others you may have never heard of.
We have reactions to this list, so do lots of people. We're going to break it all down. Joining us to give us a behind-the-scenes look at how the list came together is Nisu Ababa. He's a story editor at New York Times Magazine and a former music critic. Nisu, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks so much to you both for having me.
Oh, yes. Also with us is Jen Pelly, who talked to a ton of artists in conjunction with this project. She's a longtime music journalist and critic. Jen, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
And friends who are listening, we want your takes. Who is the best living American songwriter? What did the Times get right or wrong? Stump for your person. You can give us a call, 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our Facebook and YouTube streamers, put those songwriter suggestions in the chat. Stump hard.
Mike S. from South Philly is stumping hard. He says, this New York Times list is a travesty. No Frank Black from the Pixies. No Jeff Tweedy from Wilco. No Wayne Coyne from Flaming Lips. The list goes on. I think Mike's got a type there. Mm-hmm. But Nicole says, I'm mostly in alignment with this New York Times list, especially with the underrated Mariah Carey. We're going to get to her later. But first, let's start, Nisu, by talking about how this list came to be. I'm curious how many songwriters were on like the initial big list and then how it was whittled down.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, one of the first steps to this was that we sent out ballots to a lot of sort of people within the music industry, not just musicians, but producers, DJs. I think there's some music supervisors, choreographers, everybody in this sort of world to see, you know, just broadly sample their taste. And the list that was put together from that was more than 700 names.
Wow. Woo! Big list.
Yeah. And names of every sort. I can tell you, I spent hours just going over that list and being, you know, like really pleasantly surprised by some people I didn't expect to see on there and just seeing the breadth of different sort of nominations for it. Mm-hmm. But from then on, you know, it was a matter of six Times critics getting together in a room for many, many hours, having some very long debates and some impassioned debates as they tried to sort of figure out what a final list might look like.
Yeah. Any ideas before we jump into the music, what greatness was sort of defined as? Was there any definition at all?
Well, I mean, this is one of the things they debated. I mean, my line on this for a while has been that of the phrase, the 30 greatest living American songwriters, the only word that was not subject to debate was the, right? Like, You know, like you say 30, but like there are songwriting teams and groups on here that kind of change that number. I guess living is mostly easy, but occasionally you get maybe a songwriting partnership in which one member is still with us and one isn't. There's been a whole thing about American that we can get into if you like later. But yeah, so greatness, part of the question that they were trying to attend to that these critics were debating was what is greatness? Like, you know, how much of it is originality? How much of it is influence, impact, the role that they've played in American life and American music over the past, you know, however many decades? And I think that different people on the list probably have different types of greatness, you know, in that respect. But
Yeah.
it's something they talked about a lot.
So we got a lot to argue about and
We
hash
do.
out.
We do.
Yeah.
So I'm going to read another comment here. Paul shouted out Willie Nelson, who's on the list. Dolly Parton, he also is on the list. We heard that earlier. And then this next person. The Times list says that this singer-songwriter is, quote, an almost obscenely gifted crafter of melodies and chord progressions and surprisingly a beatmaster supreme. Fade up.
I need a photo opportunity. I want a shot of redemption. Don't want to end up a cartoon in a cartoon graveyard.
Oh, there it is. The great Paul Simon.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm curious for your thoughts, Jen Pelly, on Paul Simon, because you got to talk to the artists who commented on the artists who were on this list. And I think Beth Orton was the one who wrote about or talked about Paul Simon and called him the archetypal short story writer in song. I'm just curious if that captures what you appreciate about Paul Simon, or are there other things that you kind of gravitate to about him as a songwriter?
Definitely. I feel like one of the most fun parts of this project for me anyway was getting to match the songwriters on the list up with often like younger songwriters, people who have inherited their traditions and are interpreting them in their own ways, and having conversations with them about their heroes and the people that they've learned their craft from. And I think with Paul Simon particularly, my conversation with Beth Orton was pretty like exemplary of what these conversations were like, where Paul Simon feels like someone who it's almost easy to take him for granted because he is such a like titanic figure in American music. It's almost like there's a great essay at the beginning of the issue that the editors wrote, saying that trying to figure out the best 30 living American songwriters is like trying to figure out the 30 greatest trees in our national parks. I feel like Paul Simon is someone who really represents that, where when like, trying to like dig into his greatness, it's like, where do you even begin? I appreciated that Beth Orton picked a song called Hearts and Bones from later in his catalog, something that maybe you might not expect when you think of his most iconic songs.
Yeah,
it was a great conversation.
And Nisu, I'd love to get your take. I mean, when you mentioned all the different things that makes a songwriter great, where does Paul Simon, what are the big takeaways from him as far as the things impact the ways that you look at his work, his body of work, that makes him great and make the list?
Yeah, I mean, he has a lot of those qualities, right? You know, is one of the people that, you know, ranked very highly in the ballots that we sent out, and was like, there was a lot of consensus, obviously, around this is a major person.
Yeah,
that you
absolutely.
Need
yeah.
Here. And there is the longevity of the career. There is the innovation of the career at various points. There's a facility with, I think, melody and lyrics especially, that's really, really hard to deny. Even you know, you're playing part of You Can Call Me Al, which is, I think, often thought of as like a light, fun patter hit, but it has these like actually sneakily self-revealing lyrics, I think, where a story that begins about a sort of middle-aged man feeling like he's a joke until he finds inspiration in the sounds of another nation, which is maybe kind of the story of how that album came to be.
Autobiographical, yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's bring in a caller. Want to bring in somebody?
Sure.
Yeah, we have Bill from Penguin on the line.
Uh-oh.
Ben, you're on Studio 2. Who is your best living American songwriter?
The absolute greatest number one has to be Bob Dylan.
Why?
Bob Dylan.
Why Bob Dylan?
Stump.
Bob Dylan. Why? Because of so many things, such as his ability to storytell, his alliteration in his lyric content, the poetic function that he brings to his songs, this multi-syllable approach and this Bob Dylan sound that everybody recognizes immediately, his impact on the 60s with songs like They Are A-Changing and A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, his ability to change over time, even though people were disappointed, that whole folky Bob Dylan turned into this rockin' and rollin' Bob Dylan. Mm-hmm. And many people stepped away from him. But the content is still so good, and it continues to change and evolve. And lastly, I would say the world's recognized musicians realizing what Bob Dylan has done in their effort to cover some of his music,
for sure,
because it is so beautiful and so important.
Yeah, he'd be on my top 30, Bill. Thank you so much. By the way, Tim from Bluebell agrees.
And by the way, he was on the New York Times
and he was
top 30 as well.
He very much was.
Shout out to Bill for that stump. That was a beautiful
Anyone
stump.
Else who stumps has got to live up to Bill's stump level.
Bill
at this point.
Stumped on the next level. And so I want to bring in, our next, the next person we're gonna talk about. He's a businessman.
And a business.
Yeah.
Man.
A record executive, and Billboard named him the greatest rapper of all time. Spanish every summer, where the blue vans will come. We throw the work in the can and run. With the plans with to get funded, skate up the set to achieve this goal quicker. So all my weight wet, faced with immeasurable odds. Still, I gave straight bets. Someone felt the most something that you. All right, and
who is
Avi
that,
and
Jay?
I, you know, the one and only Jay-Z. And Avi and I was talking about this right before the show.
Yeah.
Nisu would love to give you. I mean, you got to lay out why Jay-Z is on this list. I know, but for folks who may not know, lay it out.
Okay, so I could come at this from two directions. One is that I think the critics were very interested in making sure they assembled a list that actually tracked what American song has been over the past however many decades we're looking at for living writers. And obviously part of that is hip hop, right? Often when we talk about songwriters, there's this attraction to the idea of like the guy sitting down with a guitar and being emotional, but there's so many other ways that songs come to be. And so that's one thing that Jay-Z represents there. But then, you know, his career is pretty fascinating in terms of starting as like this consummate lyricist with this such a business-like and clear-eyed and almost like a cold, controlled approach. But then, you know, he's also pioneered what a long running career in hip hop looks like when you maintain yourself as a major figure and eventually are rapping about very different things than you started out, you know, talking about.
He grew up. Yeah. And his music.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And so that's another part of the songwriting that I think that they were attending to when they chose him.
And Jen Pelly, I mean, you interviewed Pusha T on this. What do you think other artists took from, Jay-Z's style, his leadership in the world of hip hop?
Talking to Pusha T for this project about Jay-Z was so fun. I kind of didn't know what to expect when I got on the phone with him to talk, but he was a really great example of someone who, these quotes that from these interviews that I did are fairly short in the issue, but a lot of the artists I spoke to, I probably could have stayed on the phone with for hours talking about their songwriting heroes. And Pusha T was definitely one of the artists who I feel like he had so much to say and there's no end to the conversation we were having about Jay-Z, really. And something that really stuck with me from my conversation with Pusha T about Jay-Z is he talked a lot about learning from Jay-Z that even his biggest hits, the verses carried the weight of mixtapes. So I guess what he meant by that is that he's not compromising his writing in order to have a hit. He's figuring out how to have a hit, create pop music in his own image, to create rap in his own image, and to bring the same weight of writing to a top 10 hit as he did a deep cut.
So he didn't sacrifice in order to get a pop hit and the crossover. He did not sacrifice the lyricism that he's known for. Yeah.
Speaking of pop hits, let's get to our next artist. Some readers were surprised to see her on the list, which says this actor, singer, and songwriter, quote, institutionalized hip-hop's marriage to pop soul. Let's hear a little bit of it. But inevitably, you'll be back again. Oh, there she is, the great Mariah Carey. Okay, I want to talk to you about Mariah Carey, Jen Pelly, and I want to read this quote from the New York Times list. If a man had created and curated culture from the center of nearly every cool 1990s party, every all-night session, and every aesthetic shift, fashion, club sound, radio, film, tabloid, he'd be canonized as a visionary. Carey already is one. There's definitely a gender dynamic when talking about Mariah Carey as a songwriter and whether she's truly viewed by the public as a songwriter. She talked about this herself in her interview for this list. And I'm curious how you approach that topic as a critic, Jen Pelly.
I think it's totally true. And I really appreciated the quote that you just read was from Danielle Smith, who is one of the New York Times critics who participated in this issue and deciding the list. And I feel like when you look at a list of the songs that Mariah Carey has written or co-written, her catalog is completely, her chops are undeniable. It reminds me of looking at like a list of songs written by any iconic writer of like the Brill Building era. And I think that the type of writing that she does too, it reminds me a lot of girl groups, even Always Be My Baby. I always think of They're Not Be My Baby. You know, it feels so of the lineage and tradition in American music as what all of that was coming from, which is really like female interiority.
Yeah.
Which is something that for so long, women singer-songwriters have struggled to have their interiority be taken seriously. And Mariah Carey is such a good example, an important example of someone who has been, writing from the depths of her soul for decades. And
yeah,
it's so incredible to be alive at a time that recognizes the genius of that.
Yeah. And by the way, Nisu, I mean, she struggled because I watched the videos that she did and she talked about how she hasn't really gotten that recognition, even though people love her voice and they recognize her as one of the, as a true diva, right, who can sing and hit notes, but not with songwriting. And I mean, she writes hits. I mean, hit after hit after hit.
More number one hits than any American, I think.
Only
ahead of her are the Beatles and Max Martin. Yeah.
And then to sort of not be viewed, I think, by many in the public as a consummate songwriter. I don't know if people are just making an assumption that someone who comes out of the pop machine couldn't also be a songwriter, is somehow their name is on it, but they're not really the ones doing it. I mean, that dynamic, Nisu, is just so fascinating to me, because I just think if you go to someone on the street and ask, is Mariah Carey a great songwriter? They would say, does she write her own songs? I think that's what they would say, right?
Yeah. And, it's not like that's a ludicrous thing to think, right? There is lots of, highly successful pop music where the songwriting and the performing are just different acts done by different people. But it was surprising to me. I've been in the, in the comments under our list, engaging with readers. And I was surprised by how resistant some people were to seeing, even after, there's a write-up about all the songs she's written, who just really clung to the idea like, well, it's the co-writers who are doing everything, right?
They just don't believe. They don't believe.
Yeah. And to me, there's stuff that's like audible in her hits, no matter what co-writer she's working with, where you can kind of hear the Mariah in them and hear her voice as a songwriter. There's resistance to saying to somebody who is, involved in her voice is present in the music that she's making and always has been.
Yeah. Well, we asked some local artists. We're going to move on right now. We asked some local artists to tell us their favorite living American singer-songwriter with no other guidance. And here's what they said. Take a listen.
This is your pal Adam Wiener, a.k.a. Low Cut Connie, right here in Philadelphia. The greatest living American songwriter is Stevie Wonder, full stop, no contest. He's expanded our minds with his songs.
Amir Richardson here, also known as the Bull Bay. It's pretty straightforward. It's Stevie Wonder from Detroit, Michigan. No one's writing better lyrics than him. No one ever has. I don't know if anyone ever will.
And Mr. Man says Stevie Wonder, and it's not close. I feel like this was maybe you could put Bob Dylan or Bruce Springsteen, but if there's anyone on this list who was like consensus or felt like total consensus, I think it's probably Stevie Wonder. Yeah. Do you agree, Jen? Is he like the one where if like just could not be left off the list for you, or would you go somewhere else?
Absolutely. I mean, I feel like Stevie Wonder is completely undeniably one of the greatest living American songwriters and factored incredibly high in the original poll that we conducted for the list. I feel like there is sort of that Mount Rushmore of American songwriting.
And he's on it.
Stevie Wonder, Dolly Parton, Bob Dylan, and I'll just leave the other spot.
Yeah. The mystery spot. Not going to egg anyone. It could be your person in the fourth spot.
Yeah. I would put Carole King up there.
Yes. Yeah, that for sure. And by the way, a lot of people throw out Carole King, by the way. And the influence that Stevie Wonder has had, Nisu, I mean, major ripple effects. Because he's influenced and inspired a lot of young people to write.
Absolutely. And one of whom, I think one of the most moving interviews that Jen wound up doing for this was with Erykah Badu, talking about growing up with Stevie Wonder. And she can speak to that. It was a really lovely conversation.
Yeah, Jen, jump in on that.
Oh, that was definitely one of my favorite interviews I did for this project. Probably one of my favorite interviews I've ever gotten to do, frankly. We talked for a long time, about an hour. And she spoke, it felt almost like she was telling me her life story in order to explain the role of Stevie Wonder's music in her life. She started from childhood and she explained that when she was growing up in her house with her mother and her mom's brothers, their music tastes all varied, but Stevie Wonder was like
he's the bridge.
Common denominator.
He's the bridge.
She said that his music was on so often in their house that she felt like he was her father. Mm. And she talked about being someone for whom like every note he played was completely impressed upon her like soul and her, the kind of, cosmology of who she, it was just in her. And when she started to create music, it was of course going to come out, and it was beautiful. She sang to me. A lot of people who I interviewed for this project ultimately just started singing to me over
what
Zoom.
What a treat, Jen.
In order to illustrate. It was such a treat. I couldn't believe it. Singing Stevie's songs, singing her songs in order to illustrate the influence. And that happened like quite a few times during these interviews, which was really, really, really special.
Yeah. And I think with Stevie Wonder, and it came out with that in that interview with Erykah Badu, there's just something for everybody. And there's multiple phases of his career. He started so young. He sort of got that prodigy label. There's the little Stevie Wonder, the Motown Stevie Wonder, into Inner Vision, Songs in the Key of Life, and this sort of almost completely just like unbounded Stevie Wonder later in his career. And I would love to hear a little bit from you, Nisu, about his musical influence, because in the write-up, you guys note that he helped reroute music from acoustic to electronic. In addition to just having these amazing songs, could you talk a little bit about like what it was he changed about the sound of music, the sonics of it all?
There's a case to be made for him also as like this extreme technical innovator who, working with the
synthesizers
And creating sounds. I mean, you're mentioning this sort of golden era going into Inner Vision thing. And then you have like Journey Through the Secret Life of Plants, which is like a wild move into a totally different sonic territory.
Yeah, he gets out there.
Yeah. And I do think that like probably impressed a lot of people who would become songwriters or musicians to see a sort of openness in what you can accomplish. While still having like an intense connection to just like the basic pleasures of music. Like,
absolutely.
I personally think part of why he's such a consensus choice is that he will write things that just tap into a basic joy of like, if you enjoy hearing multiple notes at the same time, you hear it in those songs, no matter what your other tastes are. And you just feel, that is really nice. It's.
Well, we've got more artists coming, and we're also going to hear some picks from the rest of our team today, including this one from EP Kevin, who says the lack of Tom Waits is a glaring omission. I know someone else in the comment agrees. This is Jockey Full of Bourbon from 1985. We'll be right back on Studio 2. And I've been drinking from a broken cup. Two pairs of pants and a mohair vest. I'm full of bourbon, I can't stand up.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
A tornado flew around my room before you came. Excuse the mess it made. It usually doesn't rain in Southern California, much like Arizona. My eyes don't shed tears, but boy, they pour when I'm thinking about you.
And welcome back to Studio 2 in Philadelphia. I'm Avi Wolf-Manera.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. That's our producer, Hazel Mae Bryan's best songwriter pick. Left off the list, it's Frank Ocean. And if you are just joining us, we're digging into the recent New York Times list of the greatest living American songwriters.
Our guests are Nisu Ababa, story editor at New York Times Magazine and a former music critic, as well as Jen Pelly, a longtime music journalist and critic. Tell us who you think the best living American songwriter is. Our number is 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, comment live in the chat. Nicholas was very surprised that Pharrell was not on the list. That's interesting.
Good one. Yeah.
Alan shouts out Bruce Springsteen. He is on the list. Kat, Cyndi Lauper, Mark, Paul Simon, who we talked about earlier. Dave from Lafayette Hill shouts out Carole King,
who is on the list.
Definitely deserves to be. Denise also shouted out Carole King. Ruth talks about Tom Paxton, who's a great folk singer-songwriter. Maybe not quite popular enough to make a list like this, but if it was my list, I think Tom Paxton would at least merit a nomination. And let's bring in another caller. This is Karen from Bluebell, who wants to stump for her singer songwriter. Karen, go ahead.
Hi, Bruno, not Bluebell, but that's okay.
Sure.
Ben Folds. I mean, I think of the song Brick.
Yeah.
Where his was a true life experience, and just the sensitivity of the song and the way he just the whole song. It just seems like he's very he's sensitive to the whole topic and realizes it's not just, you know, he's going through it with his girlfriend.
It's a song about an abortion, yeah. I guess we should clarify. But thank you, Karen.
Ben
Folds is a great pick.
That's one of the greatest songs, I think. I mean, he's one of the greatest writers, but I agree with all the others. They're all great too.
Yeah. Ben Folds has great range too. He has some songs that are pretty funny too. You know, "Rock in the Suburbs" is a pretty like humorous song. I think a great consummate songwriter. So I think that's a great pick as well. So we're also going to get into like our picks.
Yeah,
for people
I get to do my pick.
Yeah, who were not on the list, but we think merit some consideration.
Yeah, and I want to. This is my pick. I want you guys to take a listen. Go right ahead. And know that voice, that is SZA, and that's her song Kill Bill.
Jen is bopping.
Oh, yeah. I think when New York Times does this list in a few years, she's going to be on the list. She's gotten so many awards for her her singer songwriting. She got the Starlight Award back in 2024. She was on a Variety's list of hit makers in 2023. She's written for so many people, collaborated with Kendrick Lamar, who's on the list. So, you know, Jen, since you were bopping with me, your thoughts on SZA? I mean, I felt like she was left off. There were some people who I thought you could take off and put SZA on there.
I love SZA. I'm a huge fan, and I will say I did vote for her on my ballot. And
thank you.
And I was just personally, because I cast a ballot. I think that she is one of the songwriters on the list who I imagine, I don't remember exactly, but because she has two solo albums, three.
She does.
Two or three. I really do, you know, kind of like what I was saying about Mariah earlier, I do think that SZA is a songwriter who she almost has like a Joni Mitchell caliber ability to like render the nuances and like of the interior experience of womanhood in a way that is really like unmatched by anyone else.
And, she has so many good songs like Supermodel. I mean, you could just go Supermodel down the list. Of songs that she has, and she talks about the, you know, when you're angry at your ex-boyfriend after the breakup, like all the things she talks about, the insecurities of being a woman. And I think you know, she just has a, it's like a sign of the times almost when you hear her music versus someone who may have written a song 20 or 30 years ago. Mm. So got a stump for SZA.
That was a good argument.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm going to preface my pick a little bit by saying that this is not like, this is not like my personal pick. I think it's to represent a genre that really wasn't represented fully on the list. So I just wanted this genre to be represented. Now, my pick probably would have been like Jackson Browne or John Fogerty. But I felt that there was no one on this list who really represented the cluster of genres that is like punk, pop punk, emo. And so I wanted to pick a songwriter that I felt like could sort of carry the weight of those genres onto a list like this. Let's hear a little bit of that artist.
So go do what you like. Make sure you do it right. You may find out that you sound done. It's nothing reserved. You can't come forcing something.
So that is When I Come Around by Green Day. My pick is Billy Joe Armstrong, who's really the creative force behind the band. That is a very simple four-chord pop punk song on an album called Dookie. And you think there's no way this band is ever going to be a serious band. And yet about a decade later, less than a decade later, they are writing a generation defining rock opera called American Idiot, which is one of the few pieces of like anti-war protest art that really broke through in the mainstream in that era. And the fact that they could do both those things, that Billy Joe Armstrong could do both those things, I think is pretty remarkable. So I'm curious for your thoughts on Green Day and Billy Joe Armstrong, Nisu.
You know, I think that you are, I think a lot of people probably have that similar feeling that there's nothing, that we're not seeing, that they're not seeing what they would like to see from the list in a sort of post-punk, you know, kind of tradition. There are a lot of things nominated, you know, on the long list. I think one of the ones that actually maybe got, and Jen could correct me if I'm wrong on this. I think one that got a big push in the room that didn't quite make it was REM, which would, you know, a lot of really fantastic songwriting that would sort of fall into that tradition of post-punk and independent and, you know, underground music. But yeah, you know, I believe Billy Joe was nominated by somebody along with the package that we put out. It includes a place where you can look through a selection of some of the ballots from you know, notable people that we asked about this. I definitely remember seeing Billy Joe several times on there, as well as Ben Folds, to go back to earlier. Phineas, who, you know, does writing and production with Billie Eilish, had Ben Folds on his list.
Interesting. Yeah. Good.
And by the way, Billie Eilish was honorable mention because I think a lot of people think about Billie Eilish and they're like, she's young and up and coming. And I think on the next list, you'll probably see her. And she is, our next person is a local-ish megastar. And her army of diehard fans would have probably stormed the Times office if she did not make the list. So let's take a listen. That is Dear John by the one and only Taylor Smith. Taylor Swift. Excuse me. Let me say that right.
Wait, now
Taylor
storming our
Swift.
Office.
Oh, yeah. Taylor Swift. And Dave says, I like Taylor. Didn't even need the last name because there is only one.
Wait, do we have a caller here right on Taylor Swift?
Oh, is yeah.
Let's
bring
that
in.
Right?
Yes.
Let's bring in Lissette.
Lissette is on the line. Lissette, you're on Studio 2. Stump for Taylor. Go right ahead.
Oh, I love her. I am 72 years old. I'm a unapologetically Swiftie. But I wanted to, if you don't mind, make a comment about when I'm on my lunch break and I heard you talking about Mariah Carey. I have to tell you, thank you for that. I've had serious arguments with people that don't believe she writes her own music. So I do think that's a testament that she's underrated. But for songwriting, after being locked up with the Folklore and Evermore during COVID, I became a hardcore Swiftie. And yes, I did go to the Eras tour.
Thank
that
you
was
so
the conversion
much,
point for me too, was those two albums that came out during COVID were like her songwriting was sort of stripped down and she really bared a lot.
And I wanted to tie a thread between Taylor Swift and Mariah Carey because Taylor Swift said that, you know, early in her career, no one believed that she was the writer. And so she was very sensitive about that. if she collabed with somebody, everybody thought that she couldn't have, this young woman could not have written these songs. And this theme, Nisu and Jen, this keeps coming up when you talk about female and women songwriters, and they're so huge, people don't believe that they're able to do this.
Yeah, it's absolutely a theme. There was the same resistance with Taylor Swift, which is funny. I mean, she's somebody who was first hired as a sort of Nashville songwriter, for others, before, you know, being signed as a recording artist. And yes, eventually, you know, sat down and decided to be the sole songwriter on an entire album to demonstrate to the world that this is her songwriting voice and not that of others. But sorry, did I interrupt you, Jen? Were you about to hop in?
Oh, I was just going to, you know, say, I have the same feeling that I think Taylor Swift and Mariah Carey are probably the two people on the list who you see, you know, their place on the list being called into question by commenters who are angry, who don't believe that these people could possibly write their own songs, but they do. And that's something that, because I'm a big Taylor Swift fan too, and over the years I've had people ask me that. So I have a ongoing playlist I've kept over the years of songs where she's the sole writing credit on them, just to pull up to show people when they ask me about it, because it's really like astounding to me that someone's catalog could be so deep and so rich for, you know, two decades for her. So many of her best songs she is the sole writer on, and yet the question kind of still
lingers.
Hopefully not anymore though.
Yep.
Before we wrap up, I did want to bring in at least one person on this list who's like more a behind the scenes person, because there are songwriters on this list who are not performers. There's Holland and Holland from Holland, Dozier and Holland. There's Josh Osborne, Brandi Clark and Shane McAnally, who are like a Nashville Music Row writing team. And I wanted to play this songwriter. The Times list says his body of work echoes the past even as it reshapes the present. He wrote this Whitney Houston hit. Let's hear a little bit of it. So who wrote that song, Cherry?
Babyface. Yes.
Who I think is one of those behind-the-scenes songwriters who was so prolific that people actually did get to know his name.
Yeah.
And he sort of became a celebrity in his own right. But I did want to talk about just that kind of like section of people on the list. The songwriters who have never themselves been like front-facing performers at a very, very high level. I'm curious what the conversations were about that type of entrant, Nisu, and like how you kind of sorted out their worthiness in that room.
Yeah, well, so I was not in the room on the days that they were deciding this. I can tell you, I was just this morning watching on our Cannonball podcast, three of the critics involved, including the Philadelphia's own Wesley Morris, were discussing this point and talking about, you know, almost a worry, did we forget anybody along those lines? Because it's much easier to think of
the artists,
the people, performers, right? Like, and who are the people behind the scenes that maybe we just have not been as, keyed into their contributions. I think there was a desire to, you know, like there is this Nashville system where songwriters show up every morning, like they're clocking in to sit down and write a song together. It's not for them to play. It's for some, you know, it's for to sell off to or hand off to somebody else. And I think that they wanted to be able to reflect systems like that, which are this huge portion of American songwriting going back to, you know, Tin Pan Alley or whatever it is. I think that we have a lot of people who worked in sort of the Motown system, which was fairly mechanized, where it's like the songwriters write the songs, the performers play them. We have people like Babyface who moved between those two things, but maybe the average person might not realize how many wonderful sort of like R&B and pop songs from the 80s and 90s he's the one behind. And Diane Warren, like, you know, and sort of industry powerhouse for these huge, huge hit sort of power ballad type things, often on movie soundtracks. You know, songs that if they come out at karaoke, you know, everybody knows every word of like many, many, many songs by her.
Yeah. And I know we only have a couple minutes left in the show, but I got to Shout out, you know, one of Philadelphia's own, Gamble and Huff, did not make the list. But when we go back to Babyface and I think about the types of songs that were really popular 30, 40 years ago, and you see how they are like a reflection of the moment in time, Jen, like music can be political. It can talk about love at the time, women's rights at the time, family at the time. And now we're seeing shifts, even in the types of things people sing about and the way they sing about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think that's an important point. Just thinking about all of the roles that songwriting plays in, you know, our world. I was thinking about that a lot. On Tuesday night, I saw Bruce Springsteen play for the first time, my very first mm-hmm. Bruce Springsteen concert. Felt like a nice like way to, you know, honor the 30 greatest songwriters by seeing one of them play. But I was thinking a lot about how, you know, songwriting is so much more than craft, it's so much more than artistry. It's also like national consciousness, it's historical record, it's like the ability to unify people yeah. and incite people. And I think it's really important that be something that is taken away from a conversation yeah. about songwriting too.
Absolutely. That's Jen Pelly, longtime music journalist and critic and contributor to this great project. We also heard from Nisu Ababa, who is a story editor at the New York Times Magazine and a former music critic. Thank you both for your time today on Studio 2.
Thanks. Thank you. Loads of fun to have.
Yeah, and now we have to reveal our Studio 2 DJ of the Day song selection. It's another artist left off the New York Times list that one of our listeners shouted out. Hit it.
Rush on forever.
This would have been my personal pick. Mm-hmm. And I didn't coordinate this. This that's Wrote a Song for Everyone by Creedence Clearwater Revival, written by the great John Fogerty from 1969.
Wow. Thank you to Nicholas E. for stumping for John Fogerty and being our DJ of the day.
Studio 2 is produced by Debbie Builder, Hazel Mae Bryan, and Paige Marie Bessler. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks engineered today's show. Our EP is Kevin McCory. Joan Isabella is WHYY's audio general manager. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philly, I'm Avi Wolf-Manero.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Thanks for listening.